Good afternoon and welcome to Higher Ed Now, ACTA's podcast on key issues in higher education. I am Michael Polyakov, President of the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, and it is my great honor and privilege to have with me today David Bruce Smith, CEO and founder of the Grateful American Foundation, and the author of the soon-to-be-released Abigail and John, a wonderful history for young readers of one of America's most important founding couples, and Deborah Dunn, the executive director of the French American Cultural Foundation. As you will see in a moment, the relationship of France and America, as seen through the life and work of Abigail and John, is a crucial part of America's history. Just a word about the American Council of Trustees and Alumni. Our mission is to ensure that all colleges produce all graduates that have a firm knowledge of the workings of the American government and of its formative history. We want to ensure that everyone who attends college leaves prepared for an engaging citizenship, for a challenging career in a global marketplace, and perhaps most important, with all the tools necessary for engaged and informed citizenship. So we're very grateful to David for producing a book that starts that process very early on in the life of a child, and to both Deborah and David for being here to talk about the history of our nation, the relationship of France and America in America's founding, and what we can all do to ensure that we produce citizens who understand our history, our successes, our failures, and our obligations to be the kind of citizens that take us forward. So let me start, David. If you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to create the Grateful American book series.
Well, I have to tell you, it was purely accidental. Years ago, I used to go to the presidential homes fairly often, and at Mount Vernon, for example, there was the sign always said George Washington's Mount Vernon. And at Montpelier, for example, it would say James Madison's Montpelier. Well, over time, I took notice of that, and it started to bother me because it left out little girls. So it left out little girls and it left out the wives. I began to think that, you know, little girls, if they don't feel included, will think of these homes as places where old men lived. If they do feel part of the history there, then historical literacy over time in the country would rise.
Excellent. And Deborah, I know that you've had a long and vibrant relationship with past NEH chairman Lynn Cheney, and that you deeply understand the point that David's raising about making the story of America's past, its men and women, holding that as a crucial priority within our education system. So really be eager to get your thoughts on that.
The story of Abigail and John Adams is very dear to me. It began when working in the presidency of Bush 41, and I walked out to the state floor of the White House for the first time into the state dining room. And there is a marble mantle over which the portrait of Abraham Lincoln is hanging. And it's a quote from John Adams, who of course was the first president to live in the White House proper. And it says, "I pray to heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and all that shall hereafter inhabit it. May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof." And I thought, that just piqued my curiosity. Who is this man? What do I need to know about him? And then knowing that he always addressed, not always, sometimes he talked about Shakespearean characters, but he would address his wife as my dearest friend, just tugged at my heart. I have raised two daughters, And a standing joke in our family as we go around Washington and we adore these other monuments is, where's John's? Because he was such a remarkable and extraordinary cog in the wheel of our revolution. And there's very little public acknowledgement of that until, of course, you know, David McCullough in his wonderful book, John Adams, and then followed by the HBO series. But I honestly support the idea that you can't know where you're going unless you know where you've been. And so this is a particular topic of interest to me, and most importantly, taking it to an audience of children. I think that also is something that we delight in our family. And I don't think that there's enough that can be published on this topic and directed toward a younger audience.
David, you've properly identified Abigail and John as the original American power couple, a rather remarkable way to describe people who lived in the 18th century, something that has a certain prescience that the nation really didn't embrace until much later. If you had to put it in a single word, single phrase, is that the way you would characterize their relationship?
No, I would not call them a power couple. I would call them a powerful couple. The reason is they worked together, but they weren't in the same place at the same time. The Madisons, I think, were the first power couple. They lived in the White House at the same time, and they worked together at the same time.
But at the core of the relationship of Abigail and John is a sense of sharing, a sense of mutual respect that surely seems remarkable for that era. Would you say that?
Oh, between them, yeah. they were a powerful and power couple. But as viewed by the public, they were not a power couple because they weren't seen at the same time.
And that may be a point that we really should unpack a little bit more. Their ability to keep this vibrant relationship going through thick and thin, through long separations. We often lose track of the fact that in our era of cell phones, when we just pick the thing up and send a text or connect directly by telephone, we lose track of the fact that a letter took many weeks to cross the Atlantic. Let's talk a little bit more about the way they managed to have this kind of relationship at a time when it was really far more difficult to stay in touch. Deborah, you may have some thoughts
on
that.
Well, I think sometime it's good to remember what the norm is at a particular point in time. I mean, certainly during the World Wars, people went a long time not seeing each other, and letters may never have been received. So can we imagine it now? No, of course not, not with the immediacy of everything. But back then, there was a different approach also, it would seem, to marriage, and the fact that both parties, because their existence in some way was so tied together, one couldn't just sit in a chair at home and not do anything. They really had to work as a team, whether it was to keep a farm going, to raise the children. They were both involved in the education of the children. It might have been by gender. The father might teach farming, and the mother, if fortunate, would teach reading, but that wasn't necessarily the case, that it was gender specific. But I feel as if there was more of a sense of teamwork and unity. So maybe as much as it was difficult, and Abigail talks about how difficult it was, and for the duration of their marriage, they were apart. How many years?
Ten years?
It's an extraordinary amount of time. But she was busy. She had four children and a farm, and she was going between Braintree and Boston. And she had a war going on in her backyard. So I do think it's just important to reflect upon what might have been acceptable then and is not now. But of course, if they didn't have a strong foundation, they would not have lasted. Though I do think one point about her not being public, his peers knew very well how important she was to him. Mm-hmm. Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, again, things weren't published and known as extensively as they are now. They knew and would say, we know that your letters, in fact, I guess when George Washington was, she asked him to take a package of her letters to John or have a courier take some letters to John. And he said, I know how important it is for your husband to have your advice and guidance. So I think maybe at a certain level. Was it in the newspapers? No. I mean, she wasn't the political animal that Dolly Madison was.
But they were also as they say, properly yoked intellectually. Mm. So she had an equal, maybe sometimes better, understanding of everything that he was involved with. And that's why, probably, she was his only confidant.
And she could be quite ferocious when he was challenged unfairly. I'm thinking of that letter she wrote to Jefferson that had him absolutely nonplussed, absolutely speechless. He's somebody with a keen intellect and an incredible passion that really did energize the whole relationship. Would you agree with that, David?
Yeah, and she wrote a letter. It's excerpted in the book of the speeches that McCullough made between 1988 and 2016 or something like that. She wrote a letter to John Quincy Adams, and basically she was telling him that he was acting like a spoiled brat and that he was lucky to, you know, privileged to have access to all the books that he wanted, whereas this friend of his did not, and don't be a blockhead. And you could see from how the other boys turned out that they were taskmasters. And the other two boys had, well, they were alcoholics.
Yeah, it's sad that these things do happen in family with different children. John Quincy is, again, such a fascinating individual, following in his father's footsteps. And I love, of course, that advice that his father gave him. Always have a book with you when you travel. You're never alone if you have a poet in your pocket. One really gets a sense of the best of the intellectual world that he picked up from both parents. I wanted to ask you another question, though. I observed that you had the title Abigail and John, and that was clearly a choice, wasn't it?
Yes, because she deserves to have the dominant position. If it weren't for her leveling him off throughout his life, he never would have made it to the White House. The same is true with Dolly Madison for different reasons. James Madison had no personality, but she had enough for two people. So that is why she deserves first placement. I mean, there would have been no John Adams in the White House without her, I don't think. And John Quincy Adams, I just wanted to add, was a grumpier version of his father.
Although grumpy, difficult personality, but something makes me think that we're now in the century of John Adams, not the century of Thomas Jefferson, that partly through the good work of David McCullough, and now with a generation of children, thanks to David Bruce Smith, that people are going to appreciate the good habits, the sound morality, the abstemiousness, the ability to deny one's immediate pleasures that characterized the family of Abigail and John in a way that is particularly timely, and that we've recognized a little bit more that some of those things that made him seem less charismatic are actually quite enduring virtues. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Am I on the right track when I think about that?
So.
Well, and he doesn't, I don't know if you want to broach this at all, but he doesn't also carry some of the negative qualities that are now being attributed to the founding fathers, whether it was the owning of slaves. And
that's
of course,
right.
That was not the case with John and Abigail Adams and their farms and all the work that they did.
And I have to draw the contrast. I'm not hostile to the memory of the brilliant Thomas Jefferson, but whereas Jefferson could never part with his wine cellar and his wonderful collector's instincts, great polymath, and obviously was willing to overspend to the point that in this ghastly epitaph to his memory, that his slaves are auctioned on the porch of Monticello immediately after his death. And you contrast that with what we learn about Abigail and John after the presidency, that they retire to their modest farm, and Abigail, knowing that they can't afford a large joint of meat for Sunday dinner, sets up a little contest among the children that the one who eats the most bread pudding will get a bigger slice of the roast. It's such a wonderful insight into the way a powerful couple refused to benefit, to profiteer from public office, and retires into good citizenship.
I think it's important to note that Adams and Jefferson did not speak for, I think, 12 years because of their feud, political feud, and it was Abigail who got them back together.
Yes, although she had many reasons to be very angry and probably a bit disgusted at Jefferson.
Right, but she swallowed it. She was a sport.
That's a nice way to sum up that part of her character. And brave, thinking about taking her children to be inoculated against smallpox at a time when there were a significant number of people who didn't survive that inoculation. And she's doing it alone. Deborah, I wanted to make sure that we get a chance to talk a little bit about the complex relationship of America and France during the founding era, since we're blessed having the executive director of the French-American Cultural Foundation. I didn't want to neglect to ask that question.
Well, I think it's troublesome these days that so many Americans do not know that we very much owe our beginning to the French. And were it without their time, treasure, and talent, we may not have won the Revolutionary War. We did not have an abundance of military expertise. That was still most of the major wars. Confrontations, of course, were done on the European continent. So we needed strategic advice. We needed ships. We needed money. We needed people. And France provided that. Now, was it out of an abundance of wanting freedom? Even, I believe, the most recent French ambassador would say, no, it was revenge. It was revenge for the British. That's really what motivated them. But you have to take motivations however they come to you. And it certainly served American purposes. But it's an extraordinary history. They were some of our first immigrants. Many stayed. Many of the French that fought here decided to stay. So that was a beginning of another period, too, that Americans may not know. And of course, when you think about cultural trends, some of our first influences were brought, whether it was horticulture or it was wine or it was music, literature, were brought over by Thomas Jefferson or were brought on some of the ships that were bringing back supplies. So some of those first cultural influences came from the French, and we've been building on it ever since.
I think that's interesting because Thomas Jefferson wanted to make our diet much more sophisticated. It didn't really work, but Julia Child made it work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It probably needed a few revisions after 150 years. But I think it's an important history. I believe that at some point, I haven't found this quote, but I know it exists, where Thomas Jefferson basically said, you cannot build a civilization without culture. And he was the first to recognize the importance of gaining that. And if it needed to be created, it also needed to be imported. So our foundation goes back between, let's look at our historical beginnings and then how culture flowed from that and how it has continued over the past almost 300 years. And there are so many things that are dear and important to Americans of all decades that have come from French influences. And I think it's nice after, selfishly, it helps the mission of our foundation to know that Europe is still an important part of world politics right now. And there is more attention being paid back to the European continent that perhaps wasn't true even 10, 15 years ago.
It is inspiring still, and I fear that it's not well understood that when we travel south from Washington, we're traveling on the route of Rochambeau, so important to the success at Yorktown that was the moment when we could lay claim to independence, although the formality would take place later in Paris.
I mean, the path from Newport to Yorktown was with the French, ending, of course, at Yorktown with a successful battle. There's a collection, for those who might like to know more about that particular period, there is a collection of letters that's just been discovered and purchased by Mount Vernon, and it's the correspondence between George Washington and the Marquis de Chasteloup. And the two were considered peers, and apparently, maybe other than John Adams, George Washington did not really think he had many peers. He was perhaps not as humble as we might like to think he was. And their letters are very personal. and yet very prescient. They talk about the nature of trade right down to the specific items that might be traded. It talks about marriage. George Washington is not in print talking about marriage. No. The Chastelu letters are fascinating, and the five that are available right now, not for the public, but you can read them online by accessing Mount Vernon. But I think all of this is great because it's new information. It makes people excited, just as Abigail and John does, because it gives you a different interpretation of that relationship for those that don't know the importance of Abigail. And people are finally thinking, yes, the female side of an equation, the spousal side, is terribly important.
If I may, I want to read a selection from a letter of Abigail's that's quoted in David McCullough's book and just seek your reaction to it. Abigail, I think it's fair to say, was a little uncomfortable with French ways, the sophisticated life of the French. She brought with her those New England values, a sense of austerity and even a certain amount of sternness about the relationship between the genders. But as she spent time in Paris, she seemed to warm very much to French culture. And this is what she wrote, speaking about French women. They're easy in their deportment, eloquent in their speech. Their voices soft and musical, and their attitude pleasing. Habituated to frequent theaters from their earliest age, they become perfect mistresses of the art of insinuation and the powers of persuasion. Intelligence is communicated to every feature of the face and to every limb of the body, so that it may be in truth said, every man of this nation is an actor and every woman is an actress. And I do have to say, Deborah, that there you are in a beautiful scarf with the fleur-de-lis on it, so perhaps evoking that wonderful tradition.
And the insignia of some of our local militias.
I say, oh.
Isn't it fun? So this is truly the combination of the French-American effort in our earliest days.
And so there seems in Abigail to be also a certain flexibility.
And curiosity.
To change.
And maybe it was just she had to have a certain level of confidence. She knew how intelligent her husband was. She was confident also, I think, of her own intelligence.
But she had that advantage because her father, who was a minister, had a very impressive library. And when she was a girl, he encouraged her to read. Frequently, he would have, you know, meetings with people in town or other clergy. And he would tell her, you can sit, you can listen, but you cannot speak because you're a girl. But other than that, you have complete access. And then she meets John. So it segued, you know, one life of intelligence segues into another. She was very young. She was 9 years younger than he was. She was exposed to it all the way through to her advantage, and it was unique.
I have to say, when I was reading the book and you were talking about how he loved to visit both her home, her father's library, and her grandfather's library, I was wondering if, was it the books? Was it Abigail? Was it the books first, and then it became Abigail? You know, but how lovely
they
shared that passion.
It was the books first. It was not love at first sight. You know, she thought he was kind of like a roly-poly, not too attractive. And then she kind of overlooked all of that.
And he
or didn't see it.
He did have that little bit of arrogance, as I think you mentioned at one point.
But you do mention in your book, I'm so glad you did too, that they were both admirers of Shakespeare.
Right.
And they worked this into their correspondence.
He used to call her Portia out of Merchant of Venice.
And again, one of those things that I hope a rising generation will rediscover, because I think it has been in many ways lost, the way that great literature can help us crystallize our understanding of one another and even in some ways our relationship. Part of what made this such a wonderful yoking together of two great people was their ability to connect through these works.
Mm-hmm.
David, I want to move to another really important topic. This seems to be the first of a series.
Right.
You did a wonderful book on John Marshall. But now you seem to be shifting through the Grateful American Foundation into a series of children's books.
Couples.
Young adult books, yes,
yeah,
please. And can you talk a little bit more about this new sense of mission that you have?
Well, I'm just interested in writing about couples, especially where the woman has the dominant position in political influence, because most of the time they don't get the credit they deserve. So let's say in the future, the FDR and Eleanor, he could have become president without her, but he could not have stayed in the White House without her because she was his legs. The Lincolns, Mary Lincoln told her family 30 years before he was elected that Abraham was going to become president. She pushed her ambition through him.
And there's another partnership that's really inherent here, not between a wife and husband, but between a mother and son, that your mother is the illustrator of this book, as she was of the John Marshall book.
Right.
And one hopes that she will continue to be the illustrator. But this marks a very strong collaboration, an ongoing
right.
collaboration.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit more about your mother's artistic style and the passion she brings to this work?
Well, it's elegant, it's impressionistic, it's very studied. When she paints a scene, you want to be in it. And I usually tell her, since each thing that she does is completely separate, unique, and great, she has Meryl Streeped it. She is the Meryl Streep, in my opinion, of American artists.
That is really lovely. And I have the book in front of me, as does Deborah. It really is a book that one wants to open. The cover painting is so evocative, the couple holding hands with the White House in the background. I think a child would have to have a heart of stone not to want to open up this book and explore it. And that's exactly what one wants to do with young readers, to get them engaged. If I might say so, it's a wonderful blend of text and painting, each reinforcing the other.
Mm-hmm. I like the fact that it has this sketch-like, almost, but also an ethereal sort of, because
mm-hmm.
I think children can look at the faces and the background and make it their own. They could put another face in there.
Right.
It's just sharp but also vague enough that it lends to the imagination of children, so it's not as definitive.
Which means that there's a whole age range mm-hmm. of people who can enjoy it in the way that Harry Potter was enjoyed. A little person, you know, can see what you saw in the illustrations. An adolescent or an adult might look at them differently because the illustrations tell really, they accompany the text, but they also tell a different story as well, or augment the story.
And we can't finish this without talking about Remember the Ladies.
Right.
Could we have a little discussion about that? That was such a strong, unusual comment for the time.
Well, Abigail told John in March of 1776, when they were preparing the Declaration of Independence, that he, as one of the framers of the Declaration of Independence to be, should remember the ladies. And for her to say something like that was very bold, but it also, and he accepted it, which also proves to me he accepted it, he absorbed it, and the fact that he accepted it means that they were equal. Now, it took 200 years, so it took a little longer, but got there.
And I think that goes back to, again, something I noticed upon an additional reading, was talking about how they chose to work on their similarities rather than their differences, which to me resonates today so much. I mean, that's an eternal message. We can always focus on what we don't have in common, but if we can focus on the similarities and cherish those, then maybe some actual progress could be made. And I love your reference to that in their courtship, since they did not exactly hit it off to begin with, but they found their similarities were very potent.
Mm-hmm.
David, our friend and mentor, the late Bruce Cole, used to comment with such excitement that David McCullough's book on John Adams is available in airport bookstores. This shows how hungry our nation is to understand its history. Whatever might not be happening even within the academy, the American public wants the story. You've done something really valuable, which is to make that story more accessible to young children. And that leads me to the question, how do we reignite a passion for history, for the understanding of our nation, of its successes, its failures, its, to quote the founding of the whole We the People initiative, the margin and the centers, the peaks and the valleys. How do we make that happen?
Well, I think it's happened already. A lot of people might not be aware of it. If you think of the popularity of Ancestry.com or 23andMe, that is history. It might be your history, but it can lead to something else. The other thing is, when I was in high school, I had really wonderful history teachers. I was really lucky. But in 12th grade, I was taking a course, and I just hated it. It's the only history course I ever had that I really, really did not like. One day, the teacher called me up in front of the class and said to me, "You know, you have the wrong attitude about this. History is his story. It's just a gossip session, one big gossip session." 30 years after that, I was sitting next to Molly Smith, who's the artistic director of Arena Stage, and I was asking her, how do these actors remember all these lines? I have a pretty good memory, but I could never remember all those lines. She said, "Oh, well, you could, because it's just stories that people repeat over and over until they become part of them."
That's so nicely said, and it also takes us back to something that I fear we could easily lose within the study and appreciation of history, which is biography. The opportunity to learn from the lives of men and women of the past, their experiences, the things that they did right, the things they did wrong, so that we can incorporate those stories into our thinking and help us to live better.
Yes, actually, I just think that there's always this quest for new information and new knowledge. So if you can give a different aspect to something that might be well known or might not be, people know John Adams, not enough probably, but they may not know about this, the integrity of this relationship. It's a new hook. It's a new way to get their curiosity and let them pursue wherever it takes them. But it all is a story. And unfortunately, perhaps too many of us were taught history by memorizing timelines, and this is repeated so often. It's real. Somebody lived it. If you can find some little thing in there, some little seed that speaks to your own personal history, it packs a punch that nothing else can. And it's hard. That's what it is. I've always said bios were the way to start when a child wants to start reading nonfiction. Bios, biographies, autobiographies is the way to go, because you will always find something in there.
My grandfather encouraged me to read biographies from the time I was 6 years old. And as a result, they're my favorite genre. And I would say, why do I have to read biographies of all these famous people? He said, because when you get older, you will have a pool of wisdom from which to draw.
That is so nicely put and touches base with everything that goes back to the Roman historian Livy, that we'll see examples of things that are honest in their origin and are honest in their end, or the opposite. And we can learn by these things. Your grandfather was a man of great wisdom. I want to thank you both for a really engaging, wonderful conversation. And thank you, David, for giving the nation something that will help us along that path to make sure that children, as they grow, as our late friend Bruce Cole used to say, catch history, that they'll grab onto this wonderful disease, a passion that won't let them go, to understand the past, how it shapes us now, and how we can do better for ourselves, our families, our nation, and the world by understanding these stories. Deborah, what a wonderful pleasure to meet you and to become more familiar with the French American Cultural Foundation. And thank you for your thoughts and focusing on the way the two nations interacted in the past. And with that, I invite everyone to tune in to this episode, to send us questions if you have them, and to be part of this great process of making the past alive for all of us.
Thank you.
Thank you.